Welcome back, my fellow brothers and sisters and friends. We are, we will have class number two of our 2015 Norfolk CYC youth meeting. Brother Dev's class, second class, is titled Martha and Her Sister. So, Brother Dev.
How are you doing? Are you with me? Oh, I just saw yawn number 15. Yawn number 15. Good. So you're going to be in awful condition by the end of the day. How many of you have an older sister or brother? Right. That's actually kind of scary. That's pretty scary, actually. How many of you are the eldest in the family? Oh, you poor people, you are so outnumbered, it's not even funny. All right, okay, good, okay. Now, according to the theories that are out there, and actual research that's been done on birth order, you've heard about any of that stuff? Okay, so there are some observations that have been made about birth order, where you're born in the family. And this has nothing to do with magical foo-foo, fluff and stuff nonsense, right? This has to do with your parents. We raise the children differently in a family without even knowing we're doing it. Okay? We program the firstborn child for success and achievement. Doing the right thing. Setting an example. Stress, pressure, and being in control. We don't even realize we're doing it. If we have two or three children, the eldest is the first to talk, the first to walk, the first to be potty trained, the first to go to school, the first to write an exam, the first to fail an exam, the first to get their driver's license, the first to go to college, the first to go to get a job. And they're the one who are told thematically through their lives, when your brother fell out of the tree, where were you at the time? Holding on to his foot. I see. And when the stone hit him on the head, what was the point of origin? Your hand. I see. And you hear story. I mean, some of you, as old as children, you can hear the story, right? We literally come into the room where our eldest would be sitting with her arms crossed and her brow furrowed. She'd be about six, and her four-year-old sister would be crying, and a hard toy would be between them. And so what we would interpret from that is, she's ready for anything, and she doesn't care. That's the furrow and the folded arms. The youngest is dramatizing what she is going through to maximize the punishment for the eldest. And so she's acting like it's a level one emergency for the, you know, the emergency department. Right? Code one or whatever the highest code is. All right. So they're different. They're different in a family. Eldest children, because of the way they are raised, behave yourself, stop that, don't do this, don't do that. That becomes embedded in them. They're about order, rules, structure. They're about the preservation of tradition, the way things ought to be. They have in their mind an order and a framework about how life should be. Firstborn daughters are great organizers. But woe betide the man that crosses a firstborn girlfriend or wife. He will feel a particular kind of pain that can only be unleashed by a firstborn daughter. And the portfolio of pain involves things like long silences, cold dinners, no dinners, sleeping on couches, long conversations with the dog, and other forms of behavioral adjustment modes. Younger children are different to the firstborn children. who are all about structure, order, performance, and achievement because of the way they're raised. By the time your younger siblings come along, your parents are tired. They have realized they did not find that they could raise the perfect, well-behaved child in the beginning. And so they give up to some degree with the next child that comes along. And so what happens is the firstborn child might be all about order and structure. The next one might be a wild animal that was raised by wolves. And depending on who your sibling is, it might be raised by monkeys. And then the youngest comes along, and there is no more wonderful baby on the planet. That baby can be toilet trained at the age of 25, and it doesn't matter. Right? Your Aunt Mabel might say to your mother, do you still have to feed him at 30? Has he not learned to pick up the spoon for himself? Oh, but I just love doing it. I just love it. He is my baby, you know. He is 30 years old. He's nobody's baby. And so what happens is, you're not about the rules and the regulations and the being perfectly quiet in the meeting and so on and so forth, like you were with the first one. Instead, you're just about enjoying the baby. Right? So the middle child has got all this power and aggravation and embedded strength and hostility in the eldest child. I will control. I will make order. I will beat you into submission. Right? And the middle child has to contend with that culture there, the parents' culture, and then youngest child. How many of you are youngest children? Put your hands up. Oh, I am special, and I am the baby, and I'm also likely the clown of the family. Everything I said was funny. Right? And so middle child is having to work out all this complex culture, which is why they have a gift for pushing everybody's buttons. My middle child would casually drop her foot down off her bunk bed and wave her toes like fingers at the youngest, who would go crazy every time. All right? Every time. Hi, how are you doing? She'd even do little voices for the foot. Right? But the middle children, because of their understanding of all the complex cultures of the family, remember, you've got mom culture, dad culture, eldest brother or sister culture, baby brother or sister culture, and there you are figuring it all out. Because remember, there wasn't time to pick you up and walk around with you. How many of you are middle children? Put your hand up. Right. So your bonding, your sense of intimacy wasn't necessarily with the family members because you basically, to some degree, had to keep yourself entertained. Right? You might have spent more time in the playpen than some of your siblings did. You were the one also who figured life out a lot on your own through experiments. But you also, as a middle child, learned to keep your feelings deeply embedded. Because the eldest child was there arguing and berating and disagreeing all the time with the parents. So they knew what that child felt all the time. Youngest was the baby, so you were much more open to hear what the baby had to say as you cuddled and held and spoilt your baby. So the middle child has to figure out life on his own or on her own to some degree. Middle children are peacemakers too. Because they understand all the cultures in the family. They're the ones who know and work the hardest how to pull people back together again. And you'll find that in ecclesial life too. Did you know that there is a very high percentage of recording brothers who are firstborn children? And that's not a surprise, is it? It's about achievement and efficiency and structure and order and the administration of an ecclesia's work. So it attracts firstborn children, right? It's an interesting thing about where we are born in the family. Youngest children can be deeply perceptive about the emotions of the other members of the family and people around them. They can feel intuitively what someone else is feeling because so much love has been poured into them. And because of the fact that really, even though they get all that love and coddling, they've got to work out their way in this complex social order that they are now the youngest member of. And they have to learn also how to work it in their direction. Right? They also have a work allergy. Have you noticed that about youngest children? Funniest people in the world, when there's work to be done, they can't be found. Some of them, at least. Right? They are also the most complainy and whiny if they actually have been captured and have to do work. All right? Okay. The younger siblings in a family don't buy into the way things are like the eldest sibling does. The eldest sibling spends so much time interacting with the parents that the eldest child, even if that child is rebelling, is absorbing order, structure, and the way things work. And so that's what they're all about. Whereas the youngest and the younger ones feel, I don't agree with that. They work out different things. So they tend to be the innovators, the ones who crash and burn social order. Right? The Russian Revolution and other revolutions were started by middle children. And who took over as the tyrants after? Firstborn children. Stalin was a firstborn child, and he was one of the worst tyrants in Russian history. And he had taken over from a middle child who had spawned the Russian Revolution back in 1914, 1917, that period of time. All right? Okay, why is all this important? Ecclesias are made up of eldest children, middle children, and youngest children. I know some of you are thinking, yeah, what if you have five middle children? Well, you'll have five variations on the middle child syndrome. Some with more firstborn tendencies, some more with lastborn tendencies. Right? And what if you have a younger brother who acts like the older brother? Sometimes there's illness in a family. And the elder child is sick. And they can't do a great deal. So what do mom and dad do in raising the children? They take the pressure they would have put on the first child and they put it on the second. So you become the de facto, the real life, firstborn child. But you're all about organizing, structure, etc., etc. And you're not easy to argue with because you argue pretty rough. All right? Most of you, if you have an older brother, know what a headlock and choking almost till you suffocate feels like. Right? Or your brother sitting on your face, another variations on that lovely experience. Right? Okay. Why am I telling you all this rubbish? Because I want to talk to you about two girls in Luke chapter 10. There was a family, and you meet families and you meet people in your life, sometimes they're not in your own country, who are like an oasis to you in your life. They're like an oasis to you. And when you're with them, you can just be you. And when you're with them, they love you just as you are. They're not measuring you against what they imagine you should be. They love you as you are. That's what we have to learn to do with each other. To love each other as we are. God loves us as we are and sees us as possibility. He doesn't just see you as you are, a struggling 18-year-old boy. This is what he sees. A man who is one day going to transform the truth in the region with the woman at his side because of the self-sacrificing work of peace that he's going to be engaged in. It will do all kinds of damage to him personally. It will cause trouble in his family, but he will pull through. And right now, he's a struggling 18-year-old boy. So I am going to get him through to the work he has to do for me. And when you look at each other and you don't just see the girl who made the big mistake, oh, you're now in bucket B. The kids that I'm not going to waste my time on. And instead you see that girl. She is going to heal families one day. Because of her love and her discretion. The way she keeps confidences and her empathy and her ability to reach in and to touch other people's lives. Right now, her life is a mess, and God is working on it. And I love her as she is, and I'm her friend. And I don't care what anybody else says. I'm not dropping my friend, because God would not drop me. So you see each other as possibility, not as the limitations of this moment in time. Because if God were to freeze frame every bad teenaged moment of your life and say, that's who you are, where would you be? I wouldn't even be talking to you right now. I was such a rotten teenager. I really was. I was terrible to raise. Awful to raise. Sullen, resentful, back-talking. You know, I was awful. You know, I had to learn that with my own children, what it was like too. Because the same DNA is in them, you see. It comes through in the genes. So in this passage, Jesus is at a home where he can just rest. They love him, he loves them. And they just are so happy to be with him. Now, verse 38, it came to pass, as they went, that he entered into a certain village. And a certain woman named Martha. Do you know what Martha means? In Aramaic, the word mar, M-A-R, means a lord. Martha means lady. She's a lady. She's the wife of a lord. And so there's going to be an aspect of who Martha is that points forward to the work of that great lady that we'll look at tomorrow in Revelation, the bride of Christ. So here is this woman, and her name is Lady, and it says she received him into her house. Now, there she is, Martha. It's an older child. And she's all about taking care of, looking after, making sure everybody is all right. Another aspect of being a firstborn daughter. She goes and she welcomes him and brings him in to her home. And it says, and she had a sister called Mary. She had a sister called Mary, which also sat at Jesus' feet and listened to his words. Now, Paul described himself as having been raised at the feet of the great Jewish rabbi, Gamaliel. And that was because of the fact, well, the teacher might sit on a chair or a little stool, and all the disciples would be sitting on the ground around him at his feet. So to be raised at the feet of somebody meant to be their disciple, their student, raised at their feet. And so it's saying in this that Mary also sat at Jesus' feet and listened to his word. Now, what does that word also mean? Well, there's preparations to be made. There's food to be made. There's platters to be organized. There might be more people. He might have brought all the disciples with him. So imagine you have now got to make a meal for 15 to 20 people. Imagine all that goes into that. There's no fridge. There's no microwave. There's no stove. There's no electricity. So what do? You make over a hot something, right? A hot pit, a hot clay oven, something. And everything is slow. And you can't just do it with two hands. And you can't do it with two servants and your hands. You need everybody that can work doing it. All the women together. But Mary, it says, also sat. So here's what it probably means. She'd be in the kitchen for a bit, but then she'd go back and sit down and listen to him speak. And then she'd hear in the kitchen, Mary! And she'd get up. She'd go, she'd work a bit, and then she'd make an excuse to maybe bring something back into the room so she could sit down and listen some more. And then she would hear, Mary! And she'd run back in the kitchen because she doesn't want to be in a fight with Martha. That's not who you want to fight with. Because it goes on and on and on and on and on. And then you hear everything you did since you were five. And then she would quietly get it done as fast as possible and slip back in and sit down to hear the word of Jesus. And then it says this, but Martha was cumbered about much serving. Now that's what it says in this version. Tell me a nice new modern version. Anybody have an ESV or a RSV or... Yes, read it to me.
But Martha was distracted with much serving.
Ah, now give me another version. Martha was distracted with much serving. Anybody have another version that's different to that? Does everybody else have a King James version? Look at you, that's amazing. All right, good. Okay, all right, so the word cumbered means to be dragged about in different directions. All right, those of you that are firstborn children, work needs to be done. And little brother and younger sister are vamoosing all over the place. What's the reaction you have? I see the smile on your face. And the reaction is not, oh, I'll do it all by myself. Let them have their fun. That's not what it is. I'm going to choke you. You! What do you think you're doing? Come here. I need help right now. Sorry, that's my husband I'm talking to. I didn't mean it that way. I'm talking to my sister over there. But I'll deal with you later with your issues. You know I'm coming for you. Right? And so she's cumbered about. She's dragged about. She's dragged by her feelings in one direction. She's angry and irritated. But work needs to be done. Servant, don't put the water in like that. I told you that's too much. Didn't you listen the last 8 times? Right? It's eldest child. Right? Right? Yes, you know what I'm talking about. Right? And she's come, and every time she spots Mary out of the corner of her eye, sitting down, the fire grows bigger inside of her. And now she's not just angry at Mary. Who is she angry at? Jesus. She's angry at Jesus. Now I want to draw to your attention. What was she dragged about in different directions over?
Serving.
Sometimes the work that we do, we forget the reason we're doing it. It becomes all about the tasks of the work and doing or not doing versus why we're doing it. When we forget the why, the what falls apart. And why she was doing it was to honor the Lord Jesus Christ and the people that were there with him. Right? But she couldn't get Mary out of her mind. And as with all firstborn children, with their strength of personality, and their strong sense of the way things ought to be done, there was a growing wave of bitter disappointment and resentfulness, a tsunami that was coming inside of her head. And when that kind of a tsunami comes, the water only has one outlet. What is it? Your mouth. And so it says, Martha was cumbered about much serving. She came up to him. Now, the words came to him, and the revised version, which is from the 1880s, says came up to him, is she burst in on him. Does that sound like your firstborn sister? Bursting into your room to throttle you because you took her t-shirt, young lady? Huh? Have you ever challenged your older sister by wearing an article of clothing it was against the law to touch, let alone put on, let alone stretch? I have seen human beings rolling on the ground, tearing out hair, and choking each other over a stretched T-shirt that someone has not worn for 8 years, only because it was hers. Right? So she burst in on him. So that means the tsunami launches. And she gets in front of his face. Remember, the man is teaching. He's teaching principles of life and salvation. And Martha bursts in on him. And look at what the firstborn sister says. Lord! Now, there's a problem here because she's not going to say anything that sounds like it aligns with that word. Right? See how human these people are? We sometimes read, blah, 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 blah. Reading done. Now I'm going to do something important like play my video game. Not realizing if I slowed it down and thought to myself, let me imagine these two people in this situation. What must that have been like? So she bursts in. With all her strength of mind, all her powerful personality. And she says, Lord, don't you care that my sister has left me to work on my own? Who cared more than Jesus? Did he say, Madam? In my family, Madam meant trouble coming down the pipe. Some other families, the father would say, Friend. We're going to have a talk in the basement with this hand. And friend always spelled trouble, right? Jesus doesn't say, you said Lord. Do you know who you're talking to? I'm the Son of God. Is that the way you would talk to the King of the earth? Do you know what would happen to you if I actually was in my power right now? Who are you to tell me what to do? Now, in birth order, what was the Lord Jesus Christ? Firstborn child. They come in two varieties, apparently. Aggressive firstborn children and compliant firstborn children. You know your cousin Perfecto, whose daddy would say, Perfecto? Go out and mow the lawn. And Perfecto would say, Yes, Daddy, I'm right on it. And you'd be looking at him, You idiot, what are you namby-pamby?
Yes, Daddy, I'll go do it.
Fool. And your dad would say to you, Go and mow the lawn. And you'd slam your door, stamp around, not do it for 2-3 hours, grumble under your breath, many words that should not be repeated in public. Then your dad would say to you slowly, I am about to kill you. That lawn is not mowed. Tonight, you are not going out. You would slam up some more doors and then go do a halfway job. Your father would shake his head because that's all he could expect of you. And then you, aggressive firstborn child, would have gotten your way. Jesus was the kind of firstborn child that said, What do you want me to do? I'll go do it right now. All right? I was the other variety. And I had a cousin Perfecto whose name was David. So I'll tell you something funny. D-E-V, there's been a controversy all around. Is that Dave or is it Dev? Is your name Dave or is it Dev? Right? It's actually Dave. Don't call me Dave! Because then you might make the mistake of calling me David. And that was Perfecto's name, to whom I was compared all the days of my life. So that's why after a while I stopped correcting people when they saw D-E-V and they pronounced it Dev. And I just introduced myself as Dev from my youth all the way through. But somebody heard Rose, my wife, call me Dave at a Bible school, and thus was hatched the most idiotic controversy that has ever existed. All right? Good. I don't even know what the point was of that point now, because I got lost in the story and I've forgotten the point I was making. At 53, you will find this will become a growing problem. Who are you again? I've enjoyed being in Florida for such a long time. It's warm here, and this is not Florida. It's Virginia, right? All right. So Martha, cumbered about much serving, she's forgotten the point. She's lost the plot. She bursts in on him and says, Lord! So she's calling him to account. You are doing the wrong thing. Therefore, she is doing the wrong thing, and I'm in a wrong situation because of you. And Jesus, of course, just saw her coming and knows in his mind, let me finish my thought, it's coming now. There's the waves all around him, crashing in the room. Everybody's thinking, did she just say what we saw her say? Is it possible she just yelled and screamed at the Lord? Wow, that's some woman. That's some woman. I will never marry one like that in my lifetime, some of the disciples were saying. Right? And then, look at Jesus. Right? Look at what she says. Command her, not bid her, you command her, therefore, that she help me. Now that's firstborn through and through. Through and through. When they're angry, they have the confidence to command everybody, including their commanders. If you're in command, tell her to do the right thing by doing the right thing. Now, Jesus could have been insulted on all kinds of levels in this little conversation that's occurred. Right? He could have been insulted by the fact that she was talking to the Son of God as if he were her servant. He could have been insulted by the fact that she was berating a guest in a Middle Eastern home. A thing you never do. She's telling him he's doing the wrong thing. And she's doing it in the wrong way, breaking all the rules herself, because she's lost sight of what's appropriate. She yells at him and belittles him in front of all of the people that are there, including her sister Mary. Mary is in a crisis of guilt now because Mary's thinking, I've caused all of this to happen. It's my fault. It's my fault. And so it says, Jesus turns to her and he says, Martha, Martha, you're anxious and troubled about many things. But there's only one thing that's important right now. And Mary, well, she's chosen that good thing. And I'm not going to take that away from her. Now you just think of the gracious, gentle, loving heart that would say words like that. When everything was stacked in the direction of a rebuke, and he had just taken a slap in front of everybody. And instead he sees to the heart. Martha, you're trying to do something good, but you're focused on the wrong thing right now. Mary's trying to do the right thing, but I'm not going to take it away from her. Now, if you were Martha, how would you feel in front of everybody? Very small. And you might go back in the kitchen and continue the work and cry without anybody seeing you. Because you'd realize that your strong will, your powerful personality, that forward momentum like a locomotive that could not be stopped, had just been derailed. Not with a rebuke, because you were up for a fight. You were so up for a fight. Because you're a firstborn girl, firstborn woman, firstborn child. And we're all about the fight.
and he derailed you with love. And with the realization, you know, I'm trying to take care of food, but I'm not taking care of my sister. And I've insulted him and wounded him. And so Mary, a younger child, wants to hear his word. She hangs on every iota of what he says. His words give her hope, strengthen her, give her something to hold on to in a life that must have been an absolute mess. If these were the children of a Pharisee who one day became a leper because of his rejection of Jesus, then they would have seen all kinds of trouble and turmoil in their lives. And Mary was so used to seeing her sister carry the can. And it hurt her heart to see her anger and her upset. It hurt her heart to see that because of what she was doing, Martha had come out of the kitchen and rebuked the Lord in front of everyone like that. And Martha would grieve in her heart, because sometimes the only thing to stop a strong-willed person is a crisis that takes their legs out from underneath them. And it's how we learn. And so in this little vignette, this tiny little story, there is so much that we can draw out of it. So the question for us is, why are we here this weekend? Is it to fool around with text messages? Is it to waste time chit-chatting with each other about stupid things that don't matter? Is it about listening to the Word of God to be strengthened by it? Are you lonely for a boyfriend or a girlfriend? You think you're 17 years old and you don't have a boyfriend, therefore you're going to die. And you're going to go into the ground an old maid. Well, you won't if you demonstrate yourself to be a woman of substance. If you're all about fooling around and chit-chatting in the back row and not paying attention to what's going on in the front, and not looking at and reflecting on the Word of God, what is the message you are giving to the boys you are so desperately trying to attract the attention of? I'm an insubstantial, superficial, silly little person. I have no deep thoughts. I'm not connected to the Word. I don't really have much in the way of belief or faith. Now, we can come from that position of silly, trite superficiality and become women and men of depth, stability, love, and the power to transform the lives that are around us because of the effect of Scripture and Jesus and God on us. So we can come from that position of not too much in our head, but silly, empty nothing, to a position where there's something in there that we can give in other people's lives. Do you have suffering in your life? Is it trouble and turmoil and heartache and pain? Bear up with prayer and by reaching out to those that love you in the truth. Get through it by coping through as best you can. And know that every ounce of terror that you've been through, every experience of sorrow, every tear that you have cried, God will take and use for other people's good. Everywhere. If you've suffered, you understand people's sufferings. You may not know exactly what they're going through, but you know what it is to hurt, to be alone, to be scared, to be in terror, to be enraged, to want to check out, to have checked out, to have come back, to have done the wrong thing, regretted and be remorseful and try to do better after. You'll know all about that, so when anybody fails, you won't be in the least bit shocked or mortified. You'll put your arm around that person because you know what it is to be in that mindset. When you see somebody in a pit, in a pool of tears, with no hope, you'll put your arms around them because you've been there yourself. That's why the Son of God was born in a barn to a poor little couple who couldn't give him anything that was luxurious, so that he could understand blind, stinking Bartimaeus on the side of the road. And that's why you have the troubles in your life. You think a cruel God is letting you go through what you go through. He's actually holding you together through it. And you may not realize it, but you will when you look back. When you look back, you'll realize, good grief, God was with me all the way through and I didn't even realize it. Helping me. There's nothing you can go through, no matter how it is, that God cannot use to help somebody else one day. And the more that you go through, the more wretched and horrible things you have to think and feel and want to do and work through and experience, the more you have those kinds of struggles, the greater will be the service that you provide to brothers and sisters in the ecclesias. And you won't be a hard, judgmental brother. In the parable, if you were in trouble, and in the ecclesia was the son that stayed home and the son that came back from pigs, into whose hands would you want to be committed to help you with your trouble? The prodigal son. Because he knew what it was to stink and to be foul. He knew what it was to eat and live around garbage and the unclean. He knew what it was to run away and to leave everything behind and to abandon God, his family, and the truth. And he had the courage to come back. And that's whose hands you'd want to be in. So what you are going through right now, God will use to keep someone else alive one day. Don't take it as an indication that God is not with you and doesn't love you and doesn't care. Because it's not true. And I'm telling you from experience. I'm not telling you from the pages of a story. I'm telling you from my own personal experience. All the mess that you can fall into. All the trouble that you can have in your life. All of the things that can make you feel like the foulest, dirtiest, most wretched, rotten, useless member of the brotherhood. God will use those things to nurture and to heal and to build and to help someone else's life. Because when you stretch out your arm and you put it on her shoulder and she looks into your face, all that she will see is compassion, acceptance, support, love, and you being completely present for her. So remember that. Sometimes when we're in the middle of our troubles, we think, you know, if you were a loving God, then you would da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And it's just like Martha bursting out as a firstborn, Lord, don't you care? Where are you? Do this, do that, do this, do that, do this, do that. And the Lord just does what he's doing to keep you alive, to get you through, so that you become the person he changes people's lives with. One broken heart at a time. Later on, in John chapter 12, their brother would die, you know. And Martha would send a discreet message, but she wouldn't want to tell Jesus what to do. She didn't want to do that ever again. She didn't want to tell him what to do. She sends a message, and the message is, the person you love is sick. Come, please. It says, Jesus comes. In John chapter 11, verse 21, Martha comes out and sees him. Her brother's died. Jesus didn't come enough in enough time to save him from dying. And imagine the disappointment she has to bear. And she wants to tell him what she thinks about that, but she can't bring herself ever again to tell him what to do. Because firstborn children learn with every burn they get on their hand. They hold on to that. They don't repeat that mistake again. Because it hurts too much the first time. And it says, verse 21, then Martha said to Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. And think of all she's saying by just saying those words. But I know even now, whatever you will ask of God, God will give it to you. So she's asking him to do something without asking him to do something. Because she doesn't want to tell him what to do. You see how human these people are? These are true stories. They're not fairy tales. They're not princesses walking around in blue robes and tall hats. And Prince Charming and all that, you know, Disney nonsense. This is just real people. Because they're real stories. They're true stories. And then it says, and Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection, the life. He that believes in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. And whoever lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? And she reads into what he's saying. Maybe he's not going to do anything. Maybe he's not going to do anything. But I accept what he said. My brother will rise in the resurrection. And she says, yea, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who should come into the world. And it's almost as if she reconciles herself to, he's not going to do anything. And then they go to the grave. And he's about to work his miracle. And he says, you know, open it. And she says, stop. By this time he stinks. So she's telling him what to do. Firstborn child can't help herself. She knows the way things should be done. The order, the structure, the rules. Don't do this. That's not appropriate. And he goes ahead and he raises Lazarus. He screams out, Lazarus, come forth. And they hear rustling. And a horror comes to the front, covered in bandages that are wet and dried and bloodied with the issues of the body all over. And they unwrap him, and Lazarus is alive. In chapter 12, it says there was a feast. There was a feast. Verse 2 of chapter 12, and Martha served. But now she did what she did. Not just about the what we have to do and what I'm doing. Young ladies, please stop chatting in this class. Don't chat anymore in these classes. Now it's not about the what's and all the dishes that have to be made. It's the why. Why are we here? So you have to ask yourselves, why are you here? What are you here to learn, to receive, to grow in, and to mature through, so that you can be the sisters and the brothers you need to be to strengthen a community in crisis?